Tell me a little more about your dates. Did you have any dates other than dancing dates?
Well, there were used to be parties in the normal way. The parties at home generally was games and sitting around the piano, standing around the piano, singing songs somebody could play. And you sang, you kidded around, and you got ice cream and cake, and that was it. But there was a lot of that type of party. I don't remember many formal parties in those days, because I'm talking about 17, 18, 19 years old. But earlier than that, when you asked about entertainment, we had Nickelodeon. That was the movie that you got in for a nickel. And that whole gang of kids that I mentioned earlier, Sheriff Baker, the Biggers and the other kids, we used to walk with our parents straight down Holland Avenue, the Penn, and there was a couple. There was the Sheridan Square and one or two others whose name I don't remember, but you got in for a nickel and Saturday afternoon. And that was a big deal. Of course, that changed years later.
Were the movies then like they are today?
Of course, no. It was all the silent movies in those days. But you didn't have the Blood and Thunder that was on it called. You had more of the classical type things, country and stories.
If it was silent, what did they do for the background?
Well, they had a piano player, and he could play Hearts and Flowers when it was sad, or gay, or the chase music, and that type of stuff. They always seemed to fit in the music. It was just a piano, maybe sometimes an organ in some of the bigger places. But as we got older, and I don't think at that time there was too much steady girls until in the later 20s or the mid-20s when all my friends went to college, but I think except me, maybe one other fellow. And most of them went to Pitt or Penn or Penn State. And I used to loaf at the Phi Lambda Phi fraternity house at Bethany Street today, and even before that, that wasn't the first place when the fraternity was first organized. It was, I think, on Morwood Avenue, beyond Center Avenue, and then they moved, they bought a house on Bethany Street. And all these fellows were my friends. And I loafed with them in the evening, and I used to love to listen to Alec Cooper tell stories of his travels, and Jack Sack, a big football hero, was one of our fraternity brothers, and there were many others, and there was a lot of camaraderie, and very kindly, they made me an honorary member of the fraternity in 1957.
Tell me how you met your wife.
That was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. I didn't meet her at first. I flirted with her. Ethan Shalit was one of my very good friends, and we went to the Nixon Theater, and Peggy was there with an Eli Club.
Peggy who?
Peggy, Christian name is Anna Mae Epstein from Rocky Mountain, North Carolina.
When was she born?
When was she born?
Yes.
Did you say when it was?
When?
She was born May 22nd, 1905. And this was about 1927 in the spring. She was a very attractive girl, and I saw her, I think we were sitting across the aisle, and she looked good to me. And then we went to the downstairs at the Nixon restaurant afterwards where the Eli Club brought the gang for a dance, and I remember trying to flirt with her from the table while she was dancing. And then several weeks later, my present sister-in-law, Ruth Lipman, who's now, who was later married to Peggy's older brother, Leon Epstein, visited Pittsburgh and visited Helen Lewis, and she had a party at the old Mercantile Club, which is at the on Beacon Street near Shenley Park. And Ethan and I and a lot of our gang were invited, and when Ruth got home, it turned out that Peggy, who had just graduated from Emerson College of Oratory in Boston, decided to come to Pittsburgh with our roommate, Florence Leibowitz of Manassas, and teach elocution. And Dirk will remember that the girl stayed at her sorority house right up here in North Gray Street. Ruth, anyway, wrote to Ethan about her sister-in-law being in Pittsburgh to look her up. And Ethan and I, we were pretty good shots then. We were around 26, 27, and he had an apartment over in the Marshall, okay, a bachelor apartment. And it was during Prohibition, and we had enough money that we could buy bootleg liquor. And we weren't looking for these guys, girls then in those days. And we weren't too interested in these school kids getting out, but we decided to call anyway. So he called, and I'm not going into details of how we switched our names and so we wouldn't get stuck with either one.
I think that's
one.
Interesting. Go ahead
and
detail.
Well, it was a dumb thing. I don't know how, but it's sort of a story that keeps in our mind. I took a name, Ethan Shonick, and he took my name. So I wound up with Peggy, and he had Florence Leibowitz. And we took him to the Showboat that used to be parked at the foot of Wood Street, and where they had dancing, and they had gambling up there. And she was such a sweet, nice kid. I couldn't deceive her any longer, and I told her, I confessed that I wasn't Ethan Shonick, and so on and so on. And she was tough. I wanted to make a date with her, but I was supposed to be with Florence, and she didn't want to date me until she got clearance from her roommate. Anyway, we worked that out, and I started to take her out, and we were engaged on her birthday. He was up in Manassas visiting Florence, and Ethan and I, he used to sell Johnny Jones' circus and things like that. So he had a business trip to make up there. So we had a double date again, but this time with the right girls. And I proposed her on her birthday, May 22, 1927.
How long had you known her?
3 months, 4 months. We were married in September 20th, 1927.
Do you have any?
We went home over Decoration Day to get our parents' approval, and Peggy continued with the school for a while after we were married until our first child was born in 1929.
What was the name of your first child?
We called him Carl. Carl. Caroline and Simon was his real name after my father.
When was he born?
He was born on November 17th, 1929. And,
do you have any other children?
Yes, and 4 years later, we were looking for a daughter. We paid one very badly, but our son Richard Niles was born on August 22nd, 1933. And so we had two boys, but we lived in an apartment on road when we were first married, the old El Tire apartment building, until we were waiting for our apartment to be finished on Hobart Street. Then after Carl was born, we moved over to the Allison apartments. And then later in 1936, we rented an apartment on a double house on Beacon Street near Whiting, where we had a lot of friends living. Charles and Louise Pottermaker, and Charles was an old friend of mine. He lived 2 doors from us. Ben and Selma Miller were just 2 doors on the other side. And my cousin Sarah and her husband Ben Levan were up the street about a block. And all of a sudden had a neighborhood group which was great. As we got older, we lived through the wars together, where you had to entertain each other. You didn't have money, you couldn't go out to do things.
When did you move from there?
I think, Bessie, I should, that was around that time was a big turning point in my life, because after being with the Williams Ansel Company in 1922 as a bookkeeper, I decided I wasn't going to make much money being a bookkeeper, and I asked them to let me go on the road to sell, which they did. And I went on the road about a year or two later as a salesman. We were manufacturers' representatives, and some lines we had unlimited territory, and they just let me go everywhere, but primarily we sent me to the state of West Virginia, where I traveled for 5 weeks at a time without getting home. But I had either new people in Charleston or Huntington, where I weekended, and one of my old friends was Gertrude Kaufman, who I was confirmed with in my Trigger's Backpack. They happened to be living in Huntington. Then there was a fellow named Joe Rush. I was married to Pan Soloff, who I was friends with, and they always thought that I had a pleasant weekend in Charleston, West Virginia. And then there was Mary Baraski, who later married Joe Kong from Cincinnati. And Mary and Joe lived here. In fact, Joe just passed away a year or so ago, and Mary's still operating there in their factory. I traveled continuously and until 1936, the year of the flood, Mr. Ansel had a heart attack and moved out. In the meantime, J.A. Williams passed away, and Mr. Ansel had bought his interest in our company. And when Mr. Ansel had a heart attack, he moved out to Los Angeles, where he had 2 married daughters. And I went out there in the fall to report about what happened during the flood, because we were at the corner of Wood Street and Water Street, and the water was right up to the second story window of the building where our offices were. We couldn't get in the building for almost 2 months. And Peggy's brother Liam drove up here and took her and the 2 boys down there, and we moved the office over to our apartment on Allison Street. So while I was out there, I negotiated. He knew he was very young, didn't have long to live. We negotiated a deal for me to buy the company, which I was able to do with the help of Peggy's father. And that happened in December 1936. And yeah. 2 years...
I wanted to know a little more about the company. You say that you were on the road for this company. I don't have the name of the company.
It was Williams Ansel, A-N-S-E-H-L company. He was from St. Louis. The Williams, I told you, was Jake Williams, Leroy's
yes.
father.
Yes.
And we were merchandise brokers. We sold housewares and hardware to the jobbers and the chainsters in those days. Our business has changed since.
By merchandise brokers, you mean you never had to keep the stock? They
direct. You're right. Direct shipments from the manufacturer to the wholesaler of the chain. We didn't stock anything. We we sold it on a brokerage.
Well, tell me, after you bought that business, do you want to tell me a little more about the business when you became the owner?
Well, I became the owner then in December 1936. In the meantime, during the Depression, I used to call on a fellow for the Kappa Wholesale Grocery Company. That was Herman Kappa, who still survives. And the buyer there was a fellow named Mo Weisenthal. We became good friends. And in the Depression, about 1932 or 33, Mo was fired, as I recall, without any notice. Pretty desperate kid, because his mother was a widow, and there were three girls in the family. He was the only boy. And I think one daughter would have been married. Anyway, he needed a job, so I was able to get him a job with Art Company as an office man. I was still out on the road. That was my job before I went on the road. And Ansel had an older brother that was in the business in Tunisia. So I got more a job, and when I... after I bought the company, I wanted Mo to have an interest in it, and I sold him in 1936, it was a fortunate thing for me that I did, because in 1938 I lost my sight completely to rare eye disease. They still know very little about it, called retinitis pigmentosa. They're doing a lot of research on it today, but they haven't been able to find out the cause or the cure. There are treatments, but it doesn't help much. I went through a lot of treatment in those days, and when it was discovered, Dr. Harvey Thorpe was my ophthalmologist, and it was quite a shock. When I knew I had it, I went to Dr. Schweiner in Philadelphia. I went to Dr. Schoenberg in New York, who also supposed to be a highly respected ophthalmologist, and they couldn't tell me anything more than Harvey Thorpe, but it was one of those things that lasted, you may be changed in 5 months, 5 years, or 50 years. I just didn't know. You start to lose your peripheral vision. Side vision until you're narrowed down to just pinpoint vision, and that's what happened to me, except mine happened very, very quickly. Within a 5-year period, I had practically lost my entire sight, and there were others who had it. They were more fortunate. I, Charlie Rosenblum, had the same thing. Stanley Rosenbaum had the same thing. Stanley, still sees, still drives a car, and was very fortunate. Anyway, I want to get this in because it's important regarding the temple again. For about a year after I lost my sight, I don't remember very much, but later on, 39 or so, Ben Miller, as I told him, lived 2 doors from me, came over one night and said, "I'm having a meeting of the Brotherhood. And you know all the fellows, and Sidney Hyman, I think, was president around that time. And you know him, don't you?"
Slightly.
And there was Leroy Williams and Ben Miller and Milt Harris and all many, like Larry Biggert was another actor, and Charles Spodnick too. And he said, "Come over and go to the meeting." So he came for me, I went over, and the fellows treated me very nicely. And I listened, and they were trying to develop a campaign for increasing the membership in the temple group. And I had the chutzpah to suggest, why don't you have a membership drive and offer them a free membership for the first year, and have a dinner in in the fall on, you know, the new members. Well, they thought that was a very good idea, and they adopted it. And next year, I found myself on the board of the Brotherhood. And it was, what you gotta say, what kind of therapy?
One of your best. It was a hobby,
wasn't it? Well, it was therapy for me, too. Because I was in Washington, D.C. And we went there with Noah Ben Selma, Nick Cohn, Weiner, and their wives. Charlie Risenstein was a past president. And to me, it was a great thing. We heard... he came up. He was president of their temple in Washington. And I was called out of a meeting Sunday morning with one of my father. Found my father dead in bed at the Marco Hotel. So we immediately had to pack up and came home. It was nice enough. They called to come back with us. And that was just one of the things that was that I remember distinctly during that first Brotherhood convention I ever attended.
Did you continue working? Did you continue to work after you lost your sight?
Yeah, fortunately, through the advice, I should call it my medical committee, it was composed of Peggy's brother, Dr. Joseph Epstein from Philadelphia. Dr. Ben Levant, my first cousin by marriage, and Bernard Callman, who you know, his mother was a baker, they're all sort of in the family. They, in consultation, they urged me to try to work and not to take my disability insurance. And I was able, through the help of my partner, Mo Wardenthal, who I'd sold an interest in the business to in 36. He lived near me, and he used to pick me up and take me to work and help me and bring me home. And I developed a procedure of my own with the help of a couple secretaries and a dictaphone. And I'm very glad I did, because I was able to earn much more than I could have received from my disability insurance. And we also were able to travel a lot and go to a number of places and meet people, make friends who are still friends of ours. But one of the most interesting things about my continuing to work, after the war, the Second World War ended in 1945, we had our first houseware show in Atlantic City. It had been discontinued during the war. And this was the first show in 1946. And it was a big turnout, because everybody was anxious to get back. The supplies were there in abundance, as well as their representatives like Mo Wiesenthal and myself, and many, many customers from all over. They were trying to get merchandise. The war was over. This happened. Fall, I would say, maybe October 1946. We stayed at the Shelburne Hotel, and the show lasted about a week, and it was our customer habit. After the show was over, we'd go to the bar for a drink before we either had dinner there or went out to dinner. And the head waiter knew me, and he knew I was blind and couldn't see. So early in this period, he came to tell me that there was a trio playing, a music trio. The man played the accordion, his wife played a cello, and a pianist, another woman. And he told me that this man couldn't see. He was blind, too, and he wanted to bring him over and introduce him. I said, fine, so he brought this man and his wife and the other come just over, table and the dish, and we bought him a drink. And it turned out he had the same artistries that I had, but not as big a person. Now, I had gone through it. I knew what it started from the beginning. He still had a little vision. And I tried to spend some time with him, tried to help him benefit from my experiences, how to, when you could see how to shave, how to know how to shave yourself, or even part your own hair, and do some things like that that a man has to do. There's a trick to it. And we became friendly. We were hardly home from Atlantic City when we got a note from her saying that they had picked up an article in the New York Times that the New York Hospital was doing some research work on retinitis pigmentosa, or eye disease, from a theory used by Dr. Filipov from Russia. It was very interesting. I had never heard of the New York Hospital. So I got in touch with my brother-in-law in Philadelphia, and he told me what he could. It happens to be the hospital for Cornell Medical School. And so I called him, and I wanted to find out the name of the doctor who was doing this work. It turned out to be a Dr. Dan Gordon. And when he heard I was calling from Pittsburgh, it turned out that he was a Pittsburgher, and he was asking me a lot of questions. Did I know his cousin? Did I know his uncle? And all that kind of stuff. I think they have a shoe store up in the hill or Squirrel Hill or something. And Dan was doing this work. Well, it was too late to get in the first series work they were doing, but he let me know when the second one started, and we went, Peggy and I went to New York and found out about it, and what they were doing, they were giving a series of cod liver oil shots, and they were painful because your arm swelled up pretty bad, and you had to take them, I think, once a week or something like that, and they thought that was vitamin A or something else, and it was going to help reduce the loss of vision of this artist. And there, anyway, we joined the group, and who were the second group of guinea pigs who were in this experiment. And when we couldn't run down to New York early, shot, but I had a good neighbor, Dr. Barbara, who was right on the corner of Beacon and White Street, and he gave it to me, and I went to New York about every 3 weeks for the checkup.
Did your helping this, or trying to help this musician, cause you to become interested in these organizations that help blind? Was that the beginning
point
of...
This is just the point. While we were in the second series of experiments, so-called guinea pigs, is where I met several people who were also participating. And that's where I met this Mildred Wiesenfeld, who was one of the patients, and finally Marty Sloan. Oh, I can't name them all anymore. But that was in 1946. And they had all had the same kind of experiences that I had in going... I had gone to three specialists who knew practically nothing about the disease, the cause, or had any recommendation for therapy. And we decided to form the Committee for Retinitis Pigmentosa Research, which we did. And it developed that was an improper thing to do. I feel it's very difficult to do research on just one eye disease. There's so many related things. But a few months later, we kept going back and meeting these people, and we were we're all getting information from where we could, from doctors, from hospitals, and so on. We changed the name to National Council of Combat Blindness when we became incorporated in 1946.
You were one of the founders then?
I was one of the founders, yes.
How many founders?
Oh,